We have a presentation this afternoon by a man who doesn't need any introduction, and I'm going to spare him that, since apparently I took a lot of time in the first session. I was reminded of the story, and I've used this in introducing people because I was too lazy to read their biographies and introducing them. But I used to use the story that, after all, you never hear anyone listing in detail the biography of the President of the United States. You simply introduce him, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. So that the more important the person is, the shorter the biography. So this afternoon, I'm going to follow that technique and introduce a man who doesn't need any introduction. Dr. Sharp.
Thank you very much, John, especially for the mercy of sparing the biographical data. Because I always have a problem with these biographical things, partly because of this monstrous title I carry, Graduate Professor of Exegetical Theology. You'd be surprised what a problem that is to people. Try to figure out, first of all, what it means, and of course, some people can't even pronounce it. For 20 years, I was a guest lecturer at the Air University in Montgomery, Alabama, and every time there was a new commandant, we would have to train him how to say exegetical. It came out exegiasical. You'd be surprised how many variations there could be on that term. But I think the greatest difficulty I had occurred once in connection with our fellowship problem. This is one reason I'm against ALC fellowship. I was up in Waverly, Iowa, and I better be a little careful here because there are some people from Iowa here. Anybody know where Waverly is? Oh, that's good. That's good. It's 15 miles beyond Waterloo. Waterloo is a place where some of the Ozark airline flights stop. Now, that means something very special in St. Louis because we have a saying here about Ozark Airlines which goes something like this. There was this plane coming into Lambert Field over here, and the pilot asked the tower what time of day it is. And the tower, of course, was puzzled and asked, well, what kind of plane are you? And the pilot said, what difference does it make? And he said, it makes a great deal of difference because if you're military aircraft, it's 1600 hours. If you're American Airlines, it's 4 o'clock. If you're Ozark, well, let's see, the little hand is on four. Well, imagine going to a place 15 miles beyond where such an airline stops. I asked one of my passenger friends, well, why does it stop at Waterloo at all? Well, for several reasons, he said. There's a John Deere outlet there, part of the State University there, and there's a mental institution. And it turned out that this third item was the most important of the three. Because when I got to Waverly, to Wartburg College, and my professor had gone through his ritual and had got me there, and I had presented my speech, he wasn't about to bother to get me back. And there is no public transportation from Waverly to Waterloo. Did you know that? There is no, and I assure you, there is no public transportation. So he said, well, we'll go uptown and get a Hertz car. But there is no Hertz office in Waverly, I can assure you that. Not even Budget or National. So he said, well, we'll go to the Standard Service Station because we expect more, we'll get more. We did. Because that man helped us. He said, now, you're very lucky because there's a bus up here from Waterloo, from the mental institution. And if you get on there, you'll get back to Waterloo and you can catch your Ozark Airlines. And sure enough, it was there. So I got on. And pretty soon the patients came back. And the driver began to count. He wanted to be sure. He had everybody on board. So he started, "You're going to spoil this on me." He started counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then he came to me. And he said, "Now, who are you?" I said, "I am the graduate professor of exercise." 6. Well, thank you very much for that reaction. It worked better this afternoon at this awful hour than in some other instances. And if I tell the story often enough, I'll begin to believe it. Now, the subject is the pastor as scholar. A certain risk attaches to that kind of subject because there is inherent the temptation to commend oneself as a model for this kind of thing. To avoid that particular trap, we are going to use an apostolic model, St. Paul himself. That will provide us with something authoritative and at the same time may throw some light on a couple of Bible passages of great significance in terms of sheer, raw scholarship. The word scholarship itself is usually connected and associated with academic life, although that age is passing. The area of learning has broadened simply because the bulk of information doubles every 7.5 years. The medic that serves you is required by his AMA regulations to improve his techniques to catch up on what's going on in his field. Every 2 years, he has to take a special course. And I think that's a kind of model, perhaps, for us as professional people. In fact, I think the pastoral office, with its responsibility for preaching and teaching, offers an unparalleled opportunity to continue with scholarship. You have to do certain things once a week or more frequently. And since by tradition, the sermon or homily, as it is fashionable to call it today, is a certain speech form with its own techniques and its own art, that provides one of the finest occasions to apply scholarship and to keep practicing it throughout one's ministry. While we all abhor the theology of Harry Emerson Fosdick, he did spend from 25 to 26 hours a week doing nothing but getting ready for his next Sunday's preaching. He was a man who continued to practice scholarship. One of the homiletics profs I once had used to say that one ought to spend at least 1 hour of research for every minute that one preaches. Now, that's a pretty good yardstick. But first of all, I think we ought to get down to a few definitions in order to understand what it is we're talking about when we refer to pastor as scholar. I believe it's very revealing for the type of culture in which we live to note that the Encyclopedia of Education has no entry on this subject. It has a lot to say about scholarships and how you apply, but there's not a single item on scholarship. Nor is there any entry in the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences. Now, when you go back to the Oxford Dictionary, you read things like this, that scholarship is proficiency in Greek and Latin, in the Greek and Latin languages and their literature. Well, that's something from the long, long ago, because there are very few people outside of real professionals who are proficient in Greek and Latin languages and their literature today. That kind of definition comes from a culture which we used to have to some extent in the prep schools and at the seminary, but which has long passed. It is there also described as the sphere of polite learning, and I suppose the word polite in that particular sentence referred to the kind of discussions that academic people carried on among themselves. Then it goes on to observe, the word is applied by unlearned speakers and so forth to more modest educational attainments. And it is to the more modest educational attainments that we will be addressing ourselves. But we are not going to talk just about attainment. Scholarship is not just achievement. The pastor as scholar manifests certain attitudes. He exhibits certain skills and engages in certain activities. And the one thing I would like to dispel above all else here in the introductory remarks is the notion that scholarship is a kind of ivory tower operation, far removed from the realities of life. The product of scholarship is not necessarily a long paper with 102 and a half footnotes. One of the most famous and perhaps infamous essays ever written, Bultmann's essay on demythologizing, has not a single footnote. It is very simply, very clearly written by a man of whom you can tell from the way he was writing that he knew his subject so well that other people would copy or refer to his essay by way of footnote, but that he required none. First of all, in terms of attitudes then, the pastor as scholar in his attitudes is forever curious. He perseveres. He manifests a certain integrity in the sense of not wanting to manipulate what he finds in keeping with some a priori notions. Then a scholar is a man who is dedicated to his task. In terms of skills, any scholar, the pastor in particular, exhibits the ability for critical analysis. He knows how to interpret knowledge and correlate it. You know, there are all kinds of books around in the field of biblical studies, where I know them rather well, which are brimful of learned lumber, disconnected, not related, have no particular significance except that they're items of information. That's not scholarship. That's the kind of activity a squirrel engages in gathering acorns for the winter. A scholar is forever investigating for purposes of accuracy. He wants to make sure that what he's writing or what he is saying is true and factual. In terms of activities, a scholar is one who, by systematic study, has gained a high degree of mastery in one or more of the academic disciplines. And the queen of those disciplines is theology. And you and I have been called to engage in that particular discipline. And so we have a very special opportunity to serve the Lord, not only with our body, with all our might, but with all of our mind. Now, on your sheet, you have a text given as part of the introduction, and I'd like to call your attention to it. I'm sure you've read it many times, but it has a particular significance in this kind of context. It's 2 Timothy 4:13, where Paul writes, When you come, bring the cloak I, as a misprint there, I left in Troas at Carpus's place, and the books, ta biblia, but especially the parchments, the membrana. Now these are all very interesting terms. The Greek philone, which is translated here as cloak, may well have been that, a circular cape with a hole in it for the head, which you put over the head for warmth. But it is interesting that the Syriac translation of the New Testament translates this Greek word philone with portfolio, a case for writings, a portfolio into which you would put the biblia and the membrana. Now the word biblia, while we use it, of course, of the Bible, in this passage refers to papyrus rolls, which were used for note-taking. Paul would have an idea, and he would write it down, make a note of it in his biblia, to use later on, perhaps, in some epistle. Then the membrana, translated parchments. These probably contained portions of Holy Scripture, the Old Testament. Perhaps also certain items of information, certain descriptions of techniques and rules that he had learned as a rabbi. And you notice what he says about the parchments. He wants them especially. Bring the cloak, the books, but especially the parchments. Because, of course, that was his library. These are the texts to which he could refer and check up on his quotations as a good scholar. The fact that St. Paul was a scholar comes out very clearly in Acts 26:24, where Paul delivers his apology to Festus, and Festus finally is so overwhelmed that he says to Paul, "Your learning is making you mad." Tagrammata, that's the Greek word, which is a technical term for higher learning. It is used, for instance, in the book of Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar ordered his, his executive officer, Ashpenaz, to find some Jewish boys, three of them, who would excel in wisdom because they would be taught Tagrammata, the higher learning, and the languages of Chaldea. It's a word used about Jesus in John 7:15. The Jews marveled, saying, "How does this man know grammata? Where did he get all this higher learning, having never memathikos, never having been a disciple?" The other apostles, outside of Paul, are referred to in Acts 4:13 as men agrammatoi, people who had never gone to a school for higher learning. They had never, like St. Paul, been instructed by a rabbi. Now, isn't it interesting in the history of salvation that when it came to the point of the gospel meeting the culture, the value system of the Greco-Roman Empire, it was Paul, the scholar, who rendered the job for the Lord and for the church. Isn't it significant that the greatest number of documents in the New Testament come from St. Paul? Not from the original 12. Well, of course, we have James and we have Matthew. But it is St. Paul, the scholar, trained by Gamaliel, who was selected, as one reason, I'm sure, as the person to deal with the intellectual problems as they came up in the confrontation of the gospel with the Greek world at that time. And just in passing, as a kind of footnote, somewhat parallel to St. Paul, may I just quickly refer to Tyndale, William Tyndale, and his rather touching letter of 1535. And I mention Tyndale because he bulked so large in the translation of Scripture. 85% of the authorized version actually goes back to him, and about 70% of the RSV can still be traced back to Tyndale. As a matter of fact, every time we say, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us," we are saying Tyndale. You don't find this in the authorized version, and you don't find it in the Revised Standard Version. But that was taken over into the Book of Common Prayer from Tyndale, and even when new translations came out of the New Testament or of the Bible, the Book of Common Prayer wasn't changed, just as the reading of the Psalms wasn't changed. So we still keep praying Tyndale, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." Now listen to this letter. "I believe, most excellent sir," he's writing to his jailer, "that you are not unacquainted with the decision reached concerning me." And then he asks for a number of things. He wants a warmer cap, because it's cold down there in prison, a warmer coat, a cloth for repairing his leggings, a woolen shirt, a warmer nightcap, and then a lamp to study by at night. But now I quote, "Above all, I beg and entreat your clemency earnestly to intercede with the Lord Commissary that he would deign to allow me the use of my Hebrew Bible, Hebrew grammar, and Hebrew lexicon, and that I may apply my time with that study. Thus likewise may you obtain what you most desire, saving that it further the salvation of your soul." Neither Paul nor Tyndale allowed their normal, strenuous life to be affected or diverted as scholars by the fact that they were in prison. For the apostolic model with which we're going to work this afternoon is taken from a letter which Paul wrote in prison, mind you, with no library around. He had to deal with a very ugly problem, namely what he called the philosophy of some strange teachers in Colossae. And on your sheet, there is given an apostolic model where, first of all, we deal with a crucial passage which indicates with what care Paul did research to figure out the ingredients of this philosophy, and then the way, in number 2, Arabic 2 under A, the way in which he responded to this particular problem. And then on page 2, we're going to make a few contemporary applications of what it is that we discovered about Paul as a scholar. And I commend him to you as an apostolic model. Colossae is in Phrygia. And that's like saying Los Angeles is in Southern California. If there is any screwy philosophy around in America, chances are it came out of Southern California. Because it is that kind of climate. Phrygia has exactly that kind of climate with the same results. The later Montanist heresy came out of Phrygia. So did the Novatian heresy. And the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem always had their problems with the Jews in Phrygia that had been transported there by the old king Antiochus of Syria. They were always thinking up new ideas, new applications of their religion. And that's precisely what Paul has to deal with in this particular letter. He's dealing with people engaged in very vigorous intellectual activity, apparent to be sure, but still highly philosophical. And Paul, as a scholar, addresses himself to this intellectual problem at their level, to provide a theological solution. It's the only time that Paul used the word philosophy. If you've got your New Testament with you, it's at Colossians 2:8. This is a Greek word. Paul did not learn this from the Old Testament. He learned the term probably from Gamaliel, because we now know there was considerable Greek influence in Palestine at that time. Josephus used the word of the various sects of Pharisees, Zealots, Sadducees, Essenes. Philo applied it. He's a contemporary of St. Paul and of Jesus, applied it to the revelation given in the Old Testament. It occurs in 4th Maccabees as a word for the true religion. Philosophy is a coherent system of thought. Paul, therefore, as a scholar, on the intellectual level, had to address himself to a coherent system of thought, to which we apply the term incipient Gnosticism. As I don't need to tell you, Gnosticism occasioned the bloodiest battle in which the church ever engaged in the early centuries. It sounded very learned, but in effect was a denial of the essence of the Christian religion. Now, I put on the board a very crude model of Gnosticism as we know it later on, as a full-blown system. And I do it mostly to give some idea as to the kind of intellectual system Paul is dealing with. The Gnostics of the third century, and that's the first period from which we have any written information, the Gnostics of the third century interpreted reality as follows. There is the realm of God. God is spirit, he is light. And being Greek in their outlook, philosophical in that sense, they couldn't understand, or at least they raised the question, how could God, who is spirit, who is light, who is utterly good, create the material universe, which is evil? For in Greek thinking, anything material is evil. Now, how could that happen? How could a God, pure light, spirit, create a material universe? Well, their answer was this. There was a series of emanations from God, intermediary beings, one moving further away from God than the next. And all at once, way down at the tail end of this series of emanations, or demiurges, as they were called, one of these demiurges decided, in opposition to God, to create the material universe. Now, the vision of the universe, which the Gnostics held, consisted of seven circles, the planetary system, with the Earth here in the middle. Now, each of these planets was run by an archon, a celestial being, an angelic being. And the importance of that we'll see in a moment. Paul also refers to them as elemental spirits of the universe, which is terminology which he probably took over from his opponents. Now, the idea was this. This last of the demiurges created this material universe that was the greatest of cosmic catastrophes, because it introduced evil. And how can you escape from evil? Well, their theory was that from this realm of spirit and light, there came a redeemer who was the revealer. The revealer, nothing more. He was able, this Redeemer Revealer, to get past these elemental spirits of the universe, these celestial beings, or St. Paul in 1 Corinthians calls them the Archontestukosmu. He was able to get by them, to fool them somehow, to get down to earth to address himself to men, their pneuma, their spirit, give them certain esoteric information, so that when a human being died and his pneuma, his spirit, was released from the body, that spirit would have the passwords to get past these celestial beings and then move out again toward the realm of spirit and of light, and so enjoy the presence of God, the vision of God. This is a description of the full system. We're not that far along yet when Paul deals with this problem in Colossae. Will you look at the text now? The crucial passage is in Colossians 2, 16 to 23. The first part of it, of course, we all memorized from the catechism under the third commandment. Let me just read it through and you follow. Do not therefore let anyone sit as judge over you in matters of eating and drinking, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of things that were to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Let no one condemn you by his own interest in humility and in the worship of angels, angelic beings, as he expatiates on what he has seen at his initiation, vainly puffed up by a mind bound to the flesh and not clinging to the head, from whom the entire body, nourished and knit together as it is through its joints and ligaments, grows to a size that comes from God. If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the universe, there's that expression, why do you keep on submitting to regulations as though you still belong to the present order of things? Don't handle, don't taste, don't touch, referring to items that perish as they are being used, that is, material things, according to the precepts and instructions of men. These rules may indeed sound wise for disciplining the will and for self-abasement and for toughening up the body, but they find no favor with God, serving only to indulge the flesh. Paul acknowledges in chapter 2 that these people are very eloquent. They use some very fancy language. In chapter 2, verse 4, he uses the Greek word pithanalogia, which is a word to describe lots of fancy talk with maybe not too much substance behind it. And yet he says, even though this is all very eloquent, it doesn't rise above the level of ordinary philosophical insights. Its formal principle, chapter 2, verse 8, is the tradition of men, and so it is a hollow deceit. Now, what Paul had to do in order to be able to grapple with this heresy is to make real sure that he understood it. This took research. He had to find out accurately what the nature of this strange philosophy was all about. We don't know precisely how he did this. He had Epaphras with him, who was a member of the church at Colossae. St. Paul never himself got there. He didn't found that church. What he probably did was to listen to people who came to him in prison, whether it was at Ephesus or Rome, we are not too sure, and then make notes on the Biblia on the elements that might constitute this particular heresy. And then after making real sure that he had all the facts together, then, with the help of the guidance of the Holy Spirit, he prepared a response, which we'll take up very shortly. Now let's look at the passage before us in order to get some notion of the kind of intellect that Paul had. And he was a genius, to be sure, and that kind of person isn't born too frequently in any century. That's why I'm always amused when people try to ascribe some portion of Paul's letter to someone else and they can't quite make out who it might be, because, you know, geniuses don't come every year. There are only a few every century. And Paul was one of those. We have to grant this. But he didn't talk or write off the top of his head. As a good scholar, he first made sure that he knew what he was talking about. And then he responded. Now let's see how he sized this particular, how he sized up this particular philosophy, what its ingredients were. One of the problems, of course, we always confront when we deal with St. Paul at this level is trying to distinguish where the language of the opponent stops and he starts, because we hear only one part of the conversation, his. But I think we can figure out from the passage pretty much how Paul had analyzed this philosophy. Do not, therefore, let anyone sit as judge over you in matters of eating and drinking. So this philosophy had something to do with rules about eating and drinking, something about regulations that appertain to festivals, the new moon, or a Sabbath day. Now those are Jewish elements, regulations about food, drinking, festival, new moon, or Sabbath day. As a matter of fact, that last combination, festivals, new moon, Sabbath days, occurs frequently in the Old Testament. So Paul figured out, now there is a Jewish element involved, a Jewish base here that we have to deal with. And he reminds his readers, these have no independent value of their own. They are only a shadow of things that were to come. The substance belongs to Christ. Christ is the body. These may have a certain kind of pedagogical value, but whatever the Old Testament said about Sabbath day regulations, observing the festivals, the new moons, I want you to know, says St. Paul, all of these pointed forward to their fulfillment in Jesus Christ. Now, there's a Jewish element, and that's rather unmistakable. But now look at the next paragraph. Let no one condemn you by his own interest in humility and in the worship of angels, as he expatiates on what he has seen at his initiation, vainly puffed up by a mind bound to the flesh and not clinging to the head, from whom the entire body, nourished and knit together as it is through its joints and ligaments, grows to a size that comes from God. Now here are some Greek elements. They're certainly not Jewish, some of these, like being initiated into some kind of mystery. What I'm doing, by the way, is giving you a considerable shortcut, because at this particular point, the Nestle text offers a whole series of very complicated variant readings, and I've cut through them in the interest of saving a lot of time and settled on a certain set of readings as being probably the most likely ones to use. There's some kind of initiation involved here into sacred mysteries. The worship of angels is involved, as you can see, and somehow the term humility must have bulked rather large in this discussion and in the teaching of this particular philosophy. Apparently, therefore, the individual devotee of this philosophia manifested his self-abasement by thinking of himself as unworthy, in the universal priesthood of believers, to go directly to God, but to go through him by way of angels. Some kind of worship of angels. And Paul points out, instead of this actually resulting in humility, of which you make so much, that's why I put it in quotation marks, what it actually does is produce pride, vainly puffed up by a mind bound to the flesh. And the result is that the individual does not cling to the head, Jesus Christ, from whom the entire body, the church, nourished and knit together as it is through its joints and ligaments, grows to a size that comes from God. Now, what could be the connection between the worship of angels and what are obviously described as ascetic practices? Because you see, the passage goes on to refer to regulations. Don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. Dogmata, they are called. Well, don't touch refers probably to celibacy. It's the same word that St. Paul uses in 1 Corinthians about that matter, about marriage. Don't taste, that has something to do with food and drink. Don't handle material things, they're evil. Chrysostom said at this particular point, you see how the apostle is making fun of these people by quoting them their own regulations and pointing out the results. Paul says they accomplish the very opposite. Instead of disciplining the will, instead of self-abasement, and I'm here toward the bottom of the third paragraph, instead of just being useful for toughening up the body, what they really accomplish is the indulgence of the flesh rather than relief from appetites and lusts. And here I must go back to the diagram. For the purpose of salvation, not the purpose, the way of salvation consisted in one of two solutions or approaches. Either you mortified the body, practiced ascetic discipline in order to reduce the influence of the material body on the spirit, on the mind, or you engaged in license, in sensual living, in order to destroy the body as quickly as possible so that the soul or the spirit could escape from this prison, the body. And apparently, in this particular philosophy, it was the ascetic approach that was being commended to the Christians in Colossae. And what they were probably told went something like this. This is all very fine what you hear about Jesus Christ. We don't want to detract from his importance. But fact is, what St. Paul has told you is only half the story. It can't possibly be true that you're saved by grace without works of law. There's got to be something you ought to do. Therefore, don't touch, don't taste, don't handle, practice this ascetic regimen, then you will develop a sturdy will, a tough body, and you will practice self-abasement. And what Paul observes is that these rules may have certain ascetic values, but they are of no consequence when it comes to the relationship of Christians to God. They may give promise of fulfillment. That's one of the key words in this philosophy, pleroma, fulfillment. They're not going to do it for you, says St. Paul, because the fulfillment is all in Jesus Christ. In him are hid all the treasures and riches of knowledge, as he says in chapter 1. Instead, and now he does a caricature, what actually happens is that this ascetic discipline encourages the plaisnomē, which is the takeoff from pleroma, the plaisnomē, the satisfaction of the flesh. Now, worship, the worship of angels comes into this, probably. And we're bound only to the text. We have no further information about this. The worship of angels enters this particular picture because apparently these people taught that by this kind of ascetic discipline, somehow you could keep your peace and satisfy these elemental spirits of the universe that ran your life and the world. This too could be a Jewish element, For instance, from the Testament of Levi, which was written maybe 50, 60 years B.C., we read, "The seer asks the angel for his name so that he may call on him in the day of trouble." Or in the Testament of Dan, the patriarch bids his children, quote, "draw near to God and the angel that intercedes for you." Now, that this was a problem in Phrygia, also in the Christian church, for decades after this, becomes clear from one of the church councils in the 4th century, which condemns angel worship as practiced at Hierapolis, which was a little city next door to Colossae. You see, if you could keep these elemental spirits of the universe from bothering you too much, then of course your life would be fuller than it would be otherwise. Here we must remember the kind of world in which these people lived. The skies hung very low in those days, someone once observed. People were terrified of the stars, the planets particularly, believing that there were some evil celestial beings running these planets and that they had forever to be placated. That's why Ignatius did a great sermon once in around 110 AD just on this subject for Epiphany. He took the story of the Epiphany star to make the point, you ought not to be so terrified of the stars, of the planets, because God, by the Epiphany star, has shown that he can make stars and he can make one that moves through all of these systems right on to Bethlehem to show these wise men where the baby Jesus lay in the manger. And he makes a great point of this because he lived in a period, and that's not so far after St. Paul, where people believed they were caught under their constellations. They were paying much money consulting augurs to see whether they were really born under this particular constellation or whether there might be some escape. Well, this is the kind of world in which these people live. And what this philosophy was commending on the order of the Rosicrucians was, well, keep these things, these celestial beings, these elemental spirits of the universe, tas stoicheia tou kosmou, placated by this kind of ascetic discipline. And Jesus Christ is a kind of model, I suppose they would introduce him in some form. That's not too clear from this particular text. In summary then, Paul was combating a religion of self-redemption which had a very pronounced Jewish base but had some Greek ideas about the material universe introduced into it, because no Jew would ever think of the material universe as evil. God created it. Why should it be evil? The God that he knew from Genesis 1. For these people, the universe was a closed system like this, in charge of celestial beings that needed placating in order for life to be full, to enjoy plural. Now that's Paul's analysis. We don't know how long it took him and what methods were required for him to put this all together. But you can recognize, I think, from the text, its complexity. The very fact there are so many variant readings given at the bottom of Nestle's page, that this was no easy matter. That here Paul had to work as a scholar, researching, listening, putting down in his Biblia the various items as he discovered them, in order to come up with his response. And that response is on your first page, Colossians 1, 15 to 20, which is certainly one of the great pericopes of the New Testament. It's sometimes referred to as the Great Christology. It may in fact have been part of an early hymn, Christian hymn, because it is put together according to verses in two parts. For Paul's answer to this philosophy was a simple one. He didn't go into a big discussion of all the concepts and of all the speculations. He did a theological approach. But as a scholar, not one who talked off the top of his head, he first made an analysis, and then he provided a theological response of substance. Now, what's his answer? Basically, God is not only the creator, but the redeemer. He is redeemer, creator. That's the substance of this particular passage. Let's read it. Well, let me read it and you follow. He, Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him everything in heaven and on earth was created, not only things visible, but also the invisible orders of thrones, dominions, principalities, and powers. You see, that's jargon which Paul picked up from his opponents. These are synonyms for the elemental spirits of the universe. The totality of all things was created through him and for him. He exists before everything, and in him all things cohere. God is the creator. Christ is the creator. He's not just one of these emanations, not one of them, the way the Masonic order reduces Jesus Christ to being one of the prophets. No, he is the creator, but he is also the redeemer. He is, moreover, the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For God resolved to have his total fullness take up permanent residence in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself by the act of creating peace through the blood of his cross, through him alone to reconcile all things, whether on earth or in heaven. We'll discuss this passage under two headings. First of all, Christ is commended to us as Lord of the universe. He is the image of the invisible God. That's of course a paradox. The Greek word is eikon, which is your Hebrew word zelem, from Genesis 1, zelem. And of course, Paul's point is to refer back to Genesis 1. Christ is the image of the invisible God. You can't see God. And in that sense, the opponents are right. He's spirit, he's light, he's perfection. You can't see him. Except in Jesus Christ. Jesus himself once said to Philip, remember, he that has seen me has seen the Father. Paul uses terminology from Genesis 1, the story of Adam, made in God's image, eikon, zelem, or the other word that's with it, demut. The point he's making is Christ is the second Adam. Christ is what we would be like if men had not fallen into sin. At the same time, Christ exercises that dominion with which the first Adam was entrusted. He is a mediator. He is the image of the invisible God to us. To God, he represents us as a human being incarnate. And he represents, of course, God among us. Now, the key word is the next one, the firstborn of all creation. That term, firstborn, occurs also in the second paragraph. Those are the two key terms. The firstborn of all creation. And you can imagine what old Arius did with this term. In fact, this was his key passage to argue for the fact that Jesus Christ is subordinate to the Father, that he isn't quite God. He's like God, but not homoousios, homoousios. This was his basic passage, the firstborn of all creation. And Athanasius reminded Arius and whomever else he could talk to, and he talked a lot, Athanasius, I might say. He pointed out that in Scripture, the firstborn means one who is not part of whatever else is being referred to. So that when Jesus Christ is referred to as the firstborn of all creation, the point of the word prototokos is that he is not part of creation. That he rules it, like a firstborn. Reuben, while he, of course, was one of the 12 sons of Jacob, stands in a category all by himself, Genesis 49:3, because he was the firstborn. Israel is called the firstborn because the Old Testament wants to make very clear that Israel is not one of ta ethne, of the nations, that she is holaos, God's people. She is different from ta ethne, hagoyim. Then in Psalm 89, verse 27, this term is applied to the Messiah. I will make him, the Messiah, the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. He's not a king like other kings. He is above them. Now look what it says. The image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. He runs it. He has dominion. He's not part of it. For in him everything in heaven and on earth was created, not only things visible, but also the invisible orders of thrones, dominions, principalities, and powers. You name the celestial beings, St. Paul is saying, and I'll tell you that Christ was their creator. So why should you be terrorized? Why all this ascetic discipline in order to placate these celestial beings, since Christ is the creator of them? Not only things visible, but also the invisible. The totality of all things was created through him and for him. He exists before everything. That's the passage that Athanasius liked to ride in arguing with Arius. And in him all things cohere. Now here Paul reveals himself as the real rabbinic scholar. For what he does is very interesting. The very first word of scripture is Bereshit. As I don't need to remind you, Bereshit bara Elohim. He used to give young Dr. Walter A. Meyer a nickel every time he recited that when he was a little boy around the campus here in our days. Now he's a vice president of Synod. We never anticipated that at that time. Otherwise, we might not have paid him at all. Now, Bereshit. The rabbis always were puzzled. Why should the scriptures begin with the second letter of the alphabet? Why not with the first? And their answer was, well, but this is compensated for by the fact that the Ten Commandments begin with Ani, Anohi, with Aleph. So they were satisfied on that point. Now, what they did after that was to take Reshit and make it mean pretty much what the Greek word arche, beginning principle, means. And then they played around with it better. And they made it mean for, in, by. And they referred the Reshit to some kind of, when they weren't thinking too accurately, some kind of intermediary activity on the part of God by which he created the universe, which later on gets to be Chokmah, wisdom, in Proverbs 8, and of course finally becomes our Lord incarnate. They never thought of God becoming incarnate, but they did talk about Memra or Chokmah or Reshit as a kind of intermediary agency. Now, what Paul does as a trained rabbinic scholar is to take this pattern of Bereshit and apply it to Jesus Christ. He created, or in him all things were created, for him, through him. You see, all of these meanings of Beth with Reshit, he applies to Jesus Christ. The totality of all things were created through him and for him. Not just things in the universe in general, like a cosmic laundry list of sorts. Tapanta means everything as it works together. The universe, the cosmos in the Greek sense. The totality of all things was created through him and for him. He exists before everything, and in him all things cohere. This is the only time that Paul uses a technical, philosophical term, cohere, synistemi. Maybe he borrowed it from the Stoics, like his word for conscience, which doesn't occur in the Old Testament, but which does occur in his epistles, in Aetius. Anyway, in him all things cohere. Now, the second part, he is the head of the church. He is the firstborn from the dead. And that's what makes him number one in the universe, that in everything he might be preeminent. For God resolved to have his total fullness, you talk about pleroma, he's saying to his opponents, I'll go you one better, the total fullness, to upon pleroma, to take up permanent residence in him and through him to reconcile all things to himself by the act of creating peace through the blood of his cross. This word reconciliation is of great interest because it means restoring things to what they were originally intended to be. He is saying in this text that one of the consequences of the redemption in Jesus Christ is that the totality of all things, which doesn't work as well as it ought to, will be restored to what God had in mind originally when he created the universe. In other words, the creation of the world was no catastrophic, cosmic catastrophe. This whole business is being redeemed, has been redeemed, an aorist participle at that, by Christ who made peace through the blood of his cross, through him alone to reconcile all things, whether on earth or in heaven. To create peace. There he borrows a word from his background, erinopoiesis, and in his training under Gamaliel, this word was related to the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, who wasn't really sacrificed. A ram was sacrificed in his place. And in Judaism, that took place on the day of the Passover. Therefore, the Passover blood in Judaism had vicarious significance because of the ram, which was predestined to be there from eternity, say the rabbis. That's the word Paul here uses about Christ as the Passover lamb, vicariously suffering and creating peace throughout the universe. Now, having said all this about Paul as a scholar, first analyzing the problem, then offering a theological solution of great profundity, let's make some contemporary applications to preaching and teaching. And maybe I should say right at the beginning that Paul was, above all, a pastor. You remember how he says in 2 Corinthians 11:28 that the care of all the churches lay heavy on his heart? He was basically a pastor, caring very much for the welfare of the people in the churches whom he founded and the churches which he knew. The church at Colossae he did not found. Maybe Epaphras did, but he knew enough about it. Now, how did Paul proceed? Or what are some of the ingredients of scholarship that we can appropriate for ourselves from this study of Paul as our model? Well, I think I've said a number of times that he made very sure he knew what he was talking about. He did some research for accuracy. He needed to know exactly what the elements of this philosophy were before he could provide a solution. Luke, remember, was a friend of his, and in the preface to his gospel, he uses the word research. He researched very carefully, acribos, to make sure that what he was going to write would correspond to the facts. That's a scholar at work, Paul at work, Luke at work, researching for accuracy. The second item that we can appropriate to our own practice is the setting of professional priorities. While I have not been in the ministry in its technical sense in recent years, my last stint was in 67, I know what a rat race it is, and gets to me more so each year. And the need for setting professional priorities becomes increasingly important. Even in the civilian ministry, I don't think that I experienced quite the rat race that I did during my military chaplaincy. And I made it a point to get up before the telephone rang at 8 o'clock and spend some time, hour, an hour and a half, reading, doing research, for the simple reason of trying to survive professionally as a scholar, if I may be so presumptuous as to use that word. And you have you live with the same tension that I'm sure I did in the civilian parish. Sometimes you've got a lot of sick calls to make, and you're kind of caught between, well, shall I go see Grandma Schmidt, or shall I spend a little more time on my sermon? And if you're working as a pastor in terms of scholarship, then the tension can best be resolved probably by saying, well, I'm going to spend a little more time in studying and preparing my sermon. You know, this is a terrific pace that you have. 52 Sundays a year, just the Sundays, not the holidays and the funerals and all that sort of thing. To prepare something new, creative, every Sunday. I think that's why Presbyterians give their ministers 3 months off in the summer, so they can go traveling or go up into Canada and reflect and figure out what they're going to do new during the next year in terms of preaching and teaching. And when I say all this, I don't want to underestimate the family problems which arise from setting professional priorities. In fact, this is getting to be one of the major problems in the ministry today, that people get so little time to spend with their families, and that kind of situation develops, and an increasing number of divorces. I was talking to the local superintendent of the Methodist Church here some weeks ago, and he just exclaimed at the number of divorce cases of clergy he had to deal with in this particular area. And I said to Pastor Niederbrach of Muncie, Indiana, a couple Sundays ago when I was up there, and he said, well, the Methodists aren't alone in this. And apparently, judging from his observation, that's a problem also among us, alas. Nevertheless, the pastor working as scholar has the task of setting professional priorities. Paul was in prison. He could have spent his time lamenting, weeping, talking to other prisoners, complaining about their mutual fate, the kind of stuff that's described in contemporary Russian novels, particularly Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his Gulag Archipelago. But he didn't. He asked Timothy to bring his Biblia and his Membrana because he wanted to go to work as a scholar. Then, see, checking out specifics. And let me say, even though I'm not a homiletician, that one of the ways in which teaching and preaching can be made interesting is to be specific. Not general. There's nothing that will put a person to sleep, the audience to sleep, faster than talking in generalities. Just a simple instance to illustrate the point. If you have a Thanksgiving Day service, then please go to the library and get yourself a copy of the President's Thanksgiving Day Proclamation and unroll it. Read from it. Be specific. And you'd be surprised what that does for the audience. If you're talking about a certain problem, be specific. Paul's terminology is very specific. He took it from his opponents and worked with it for whatever he could. Next, Paul was dedicated to the truth. That is to say, he was not about to manipulate things in order to make them come out a certain way on which he had decided ahead of time. I live with that temptation, you live with it, to manipulate a Bible passage occasionally to make it mean something a little bit different from what it really says, because I got a big idea I want to get across, and it would help if I had a little biblical support. There's a very interesting example of that in Studies Number 1 out of LACUSA, Lutheran Council USA, on peace, conscience, and war, where all at once they quote the Authorized Version. And of course, the first time I read it, I thought to myself, now, why would these birds use the Authorized Version? Because they're all this high-flying, sophisticated type. Well, I know why, because it so happens that the Authorized Version, in its translation, makes the particular point that is to be made. The Greek text doesn't, nor does the RSV, nor the NEB, but the AV does. So all at once, they reach way back to King, I almost said St. James's time, King James' time, to quote that particular version from Shakespeare's day. Now that is a lack of integrity. That's what you call manipulating a text in order to make a point which you've already decided to make and for which you need some support. Next, out of Paul, and you've read him enough to appreciate, you get an awful lot of enrichment, and that enrichment can be yours if, as a scholar, you do what he did, look at things, examine them, do research into the text. And Bill Smeller can testify to this. One thing that we always have to keep, and here, Rudy, I don't want to forget you, Rudolph Hump, that we have to get across to our students. Look, that text says just one thing, and your job is to say what that text says. You got another Sunday coming. You can worry about another text some other time. This text is the one that you work with and research into. When I do an exegetical course, the last part of it always consists, and I apologize to those of you who have had to go through this routine at this point, as a matter of survival, 15 steps. How you get from the text to your sermon outline. 15 steps, five at a time. Now, that's not the kind of thing you can do every Sunday. But I always tell the students, look, if you take the general pericope system and you decide you're going to do one gospel a month for 4 years, one epistle a month for 4 years, in 8 years, you really got a barrel. You have really put yourself through the paces and have accumulated data and information that can be invaluable, especially in terms of enrichment. I saw a field worker here the other day who was with one of our St. Louis congregations, and he said, you know, I've worked there for a year and I hear the same sermon every Sunday. It's got a different title, but it's the same material. And I know exactly what he means. Regardless of what the text is, it goes over the same routine. Scholarship can provide enrichment, variety, and help the people grow in their understanding of Scripture and in their spiritual life. Now that requires, number F, indefatigable zeal. There is no end to this. This is time-consuming and takes a lot of energy. A simple thing like checking out the information you're using, checking the primary sources. For instance, most of you, I'm sure, have problems with people who've read Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth. This is deadly stuff. First of all, because it reads very piously at certain places. Bible passages are thrown in conveniently. And written in such a way that it reads downhill. Now, I don't know what you've done in that particular situation. But take Hal Lindsey and check out his footnotes. That's very interesting. I did this. I had a paper for the pastoral conference in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, and they asked me to evaluate prophetic theology, this whole business that comes out of Dallas Theological Seminary, of which Hal Lindsey is a good example. Well, I checked Hal Lindsey's footnotes. He's got some real scholarly sounding references to Gazzini's, Kyle and Dalish's commentary. Sounds terrific until you look it up. And there isn't anything of what Hal Lindsey says in either Gazzini's or Kyle Dalish. Now, Gazzini's had more sense than to take Rosh out of Ezekiel 38 and make it equal Russians, or Magog equal Moscow. But the footnotes in Hal Lindsey would lead you to believe that these venerable scholars actually said that. Well, I just happened to have a Gazzini's very handy and looked it up. And there's nothing of the kind there. This is a matter of checking out primary resources. Endless care for detail. I don't, please misunderstand me here. I do not understand how people can preach without having written out what they're going to say. I just don't understand it, because of the burden involved and the responsibility. Writing still makes an exact man, to quote Francis Bacon. This is painstaking work. To be sure you've got the right word. Roger's thesaurus is very valuable at that point. Then the use of adequate tools. And of course, here we are very fortunate to have theological word books, which Luther could never have dreamed of in his day. Dictionaries. You know, you marvel at this man, how he could guess at meanings in the book of Job when he didn't have a dictionary to tell him what these words meant. And he got very close in most cases. A fabulous genius. Now, we have the dictionaries. We've got the theological word books. Von Allman. Do you know Von Allman's Guide to the Bible? Tremendous thing. Or Richardson's word book. And if you really want to go to town, you take Kittle. 9 volumes of it, translated by Bromley. In a day when information, the body of information, doubles every 7.5 years, that's geometric progression, we really have a job on our hands. I guess you know the old distinction between the philosopher and the specialist. The philosopher is one who knows less and less about more and more until he knows nothing about everything. While a specialist is one who knows more and more about less until he knows everything about nothing. Well, in our day, we have to become specialists. And at schools, problems are so big that teams of people have to work in laboratories in order to accomplish certain things. And in New Testament, if I may be very professional at that point, it's very hard to keep up just with the literature on one book like the Gospel of Mark in our day. Then, continuing education. This is the commercial. We are set up at the seminary for all kinds of programs in continuing education, of which this is a part, incidentally. We have cassettes, we have correspondence school courses, we've got summer school sessions. One starts, Wednesday, isn't it? We've got the Concordia Journal, that's my real commercial right there. Why? To help pastors operate as scholars. I was in my last civilian parish many, many years ago when life was very simple, up in a place called Athens, Wisconsin. Anybody ever heard of Athens, Wisconsin? 6 miles from anywhere. Well, I had written my doctoral dissertation at Washington University on the influence of the social changes in Athens on the development of Greek tragedy. And I always had the problem of explaining I wasn't talking about that town up there in Wisconsin, but ancient Athens. Well, even then, I made it a point to spend 3 weeks every summer at Wartburg Seminary, which was one of two Lutheran seminaries I discovered that had graduate courses, and spent those weeks with Dr. Roy. And that was one of the most enriching experiences, to work with a man whom you could ask any question in theology and he seemed to know the answer. And he made me work hard. For instance, I did a Pentecost sermon once on Acts 2 with the title, Undoing Babel. He put a little note there. Verstehen die Mauer von Athens, so einen Titel. Well, that gets you down from the abstract in scholarship to where one ought to be. Now, having put in the commercial, let me put in the final point here. It is always helpful to be the master of one subject in particular, and it may be a very small area. My particular forte is Stephen, Acts 7. And knowing one subject well has a kind of integrating power. It's like a magnet under a saucer, you know, it pulls all these iron BB shots together. And no matter what you read, you're kind of related and integrated. This is what we call correlation. Or First Peter. So my concluding remarks, Bill, it's just about 3 o'clock. My concluding remarks are on page 2. Theology has the task of interpreting reality in light of the biblical revelation. And I can't think of a greater privilege than that, the one that St. Paul had. That's part of the apostolic succession, I would say, in a non-episcopal sense. The church is once more up against the challenge not only to outpray, to outwork, but also to outthink her enemies, the way Paul did. Peter put it like this, gird up the loins of your mind. Thank you very much.